Linux Luddites, episode 55, for the 27th of September, 2015. Hello and welcome to Linux Luddites, the show where we trial the latest free and open source software and then decide that we like the old stuff better. I'm Joe.
I'm Pete.
And I'm Jesse. Now, the alert amongst you will have noticed there's a slight change to the usual lineup, and this is because for the next month, Paddy has some major work commitments and isn't able to guarantee his time necessary for the background research and the recording schedule that this show demands. So rather than leaving a question over whether he'll be able to join us or not, and potentially sort of dropping Joe and I in it if he can't make it at the last minute, we've decided that it'd be better to plan a clear month, and then we can actively make amends for his absence. So for the two new shows this month, we'll have special guests, and for the feedback shows, it'll just be Joe and I. So speaking of special guests, it's with great pleasure that we welcome the very knowledgeable Pete Cannon. So how's it going, Pete?
I don't know about the knowledgeable. not too bad. It's been a while since I've been on the airwaves, so to speak.
And let's get this out of the way. First of all, you're a Fedora user.
I think I prefer to be known more as an open source user.
Fair enough. No, it's just that none of us on this show use Fedora or like it. We're all kind of Debian Ubuntu fanboys.
Yeah. You're all Ubuntu fanboys. And I have sort of gone full circle. When I first started out on this rocky road of using Linux back in around about 2000, I started out with Red Hat before, obviously, it sort of went to the support style. And then I sort of floated around and used other bits and bobs. I used Mandrake for a while, but then I became quite a big Arch Linux fan and used that for quite a number of years until such time as Judd Vincent handed over the reins. And in my opinion, it all started to go a bit pear-shaped, really. It was then that I thought, right, well, what should I do now? And I thought, well, I'll tell you what, I'll try Fedora again. And I've been using Fedora for the last couple of years, to be honest with you. So as far as sort of Linux is concerned, I'm not really a loyal user. I'll sort of use anything. I have been using Fedora for a while, but I mean, I'll use anything, to be honest with you.
And some of the listeners might recognise your voice. Could you just bring everyone up to speed on what other podcasts you've been on?
I recognise my voice, yeah. Those dulcet tones, as someone once said to me.
Precisely.
So I, for my sins, was one of the... I shouldn't really say that, because officially it hasn't ended, but I was one of the co-hosts of the Dick Turpin Roadshow. We ran for just over 3 years. Do you know what? I can't remember how many episodes we did. I think we did something like 92 episodes. Matt, my co-conspirator, got married and has a lot of commitments at this point in time, and decided that he needed a bit of a break from the show. And so what we said was, well, you know, we'd have a bit of a break. And unfortunately, that break seems to be going on and on and on. I don't know. Maybe we'll come back. Maybe we'll come back, I don't know, in the new year. We'll shock everybody. One day you'll suddenly see your feeds burst back into life.
All right. Well, let's just tell the listeners what we've got on this show. We've got the latest news, of course, in which case we cover some of the latest FOSS wins. There's a few mobile updates. There's the ongoing push towards the Internet of Things. And given that we've just heard Pete's a Fedora user, we'll see what we make of the new GNOME 3.18. And after that, Pete rocked the international Linux world this week with a Google Plus post, which stated the new possible Linux mantra. And so we discussed that over a pint. And with that, let's get on with the news.
So, as Jesse said, let's start off with some international FOSS wins. And the first one is the Italian military are going to switch to LibreOffice and ODF, hey, which is good news. Yeah, they're going to switch 150,000 PC workstations, making it Europe's second largest LibreOffice implementation. Definitely good news.
Hmm. I know we're going to touch on this possibly later on, but I mean, this is the sort of story that excites me more than this, the famous saying of when will we see the year of the Linux desktop? This is where I've always felt that, you know, we win in the use of open source software. You know, cross-platform applications such as LibreOffice is the way forward, I think.
Well, it's certainly the stepping stone, isn't it? You get people used to Firefox and LibreOffice, and that once you've done that, then you can shift them over to the open source OS as well.
Mm. I work in a predominantly Microsoft-based company. We're an IT solutions provider. And, well, it doesn't bring a smile to my face anymore because it's become sort of standard that you speak to a lot of our customers and they're all running sort of Chrome, which I know some people would argue isn't strictly open source, but certainly they're running Firefox. I've got some customers are running Thunderbird and stuff like this. And you think, you know, this is great that, you know, that they're getting used to open source software. It's just that little step to make them use something like Yellow Dog Linux or something.
Yeah, a small step. I mean, if they're using those applications in place of, you know, proprietary ones, and they're on, I assume, Windows or Mac or something, then you're right. It's clearly they're competing one to one and are able to win, and those people prefer that. So it's you know, like I say, it's a big win. And Joe's point here about them being the second biggest movement is the French Interior Ministry, which we've covered previously on the show, has like 240,000 desktops running some sort of open source Linux distribution, and these are the Italians are moving 150,000 over. So just to put into context, I think I was surprised by the numbers myself, because looking up, the one that gets covered a lot is the city of Munich in Germany, of course, and they've got 17,000. So when you look at those numbers, 17,000 in Munich is not, well, it's nothing compared to the 150 of the Italians or the 240,000 of the French. I was just surprised by the scale of what's going on here.
Yeah, but in Munich, you're talking about the OS. They're using a Linux operating system, whereas here we're just talking about the use of LibreOffice, you know, open source office tools, which is, I would imagine, one of the biggest, apart from the browser and maybe the email client, the Office suite is going to be the most used piece of software. So, yeah, I mean, I think the big win with Munich is that they've totally eradicated proprietary software, at least, you know, almost totally anyway. Whereas here, these are stepping stones that we're talking about, which I think need to take place in order to get to the bigger goal of moving away from Microsoft.
See, the way that to view this and to go back on what I was saying just a few moments ago is what you need to think about this is once you've got your user base used to using open source software applications such as LibreOffice, if they've been used to using it on Windows, for example, there is no sea change for them if they moved over to an Ubuntu-based operating system, because most users don't care whatsoever about the OS. They care about the applications they use in an office environment. You know, they might have the when they find that they can't play solitaire on there or something like that, or they can't load their iTunes on there, but they'll be used to day to day working with LibreOffice anyway. So the fact that it's on an Ubuntu desktop won't matter a fig to them.
And Joe's point about the browser and the office suite, I use the browser as my second or third or even fourth most common sort of application. Is always Word, Excel, dare I say it, Outlook, you know, the big three, as it were. But carrying on with the FOSS wins, the Indians are also making their own OS, and this is a continuation of one they started in 2007 and was last released in 2012, called BOSS, which I think is a great name, but the Bharat Operating System Solutions, and they see it as a requirement or a need to try and overcome some of the vulnerabilities that exist in sort of government, and the fact that by using more well-known, let's say, proprietary operating systems, they are open to sort of Chinese hackers and also groups of Indian hackers. And this one that they're producing, this BOSS operating system, is going to be certified by the Linux Foundations for compliance with the Linux standard base, which I think, you know, gives that sort of seal of approval and shows they've thought about it and trying to go about it the right way.
I did have a look at this, and it looked a pretty rock solid good operating system to me. Based on Debian, of course.
It seems to be a growing trend internationally that as countries kind of don't really trust America, they don't really want to trust an operating system made by a big American company. And, you know, and also there's the cost element of it as well, you know, not having to buy licenses. So it seems to be growing, not so much in America and the UK, but internationally, certainly. I keep seeing these news stories about, you know, places popping up using open source software and moving to Linux.
Especially India, you know, we see this with sort of the mobile phones. I mean, it's a huge market, you know, even though a lot of us in the West don't think that India's got a lot of money. It is, in actual fact, a huge market there.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, India and China, both massive markets.
Yeah, I think the thing that surprised me about this story was it was saying further down that the leaks from Edward Snowden showed that India was the most scrutinised nation by some of the US intelligence agencies. And I kind of figured it would be, you know, Russia or China or, dare I say it, some of the European nations. So I thought it was interesting that it was India that had the most kind of attacks and things by the US, which wasn't really something I thought about.
So next up is a story about Ubuntu Linux-based open source OS running on 42% of Dell PCs sold in China.
Well, whether it's running on them or not is another... they might be sold with that, but whether they get a pirated version of Windows put straight on them or not, I think is another matter altogether.
My thought about this was, we all know how Pete is cynical about these sorts of stories, and I can't help it. What I would like to say, stroke point out, is that China is a communist country. And Kai Lin, I think it's called Kai Lin, if I remember right.
Yeah, Ubuntu Kai Lin, yeah.
Ubuntu Kai Lin is the official operating system of China. And I should imagine lots of people would at least, as you quite rightly say, will like to see an invoice saying that they bought a PC with Kai Lin on it. So I'm not sure that that's the 42% is a believable figure, shall we say. They probably are buying 40%, 42% of them, but the point I'm trying to get across here is that they've got no other choice but to buy it with Kai Lin on.
Yeah, so the 58% of people are sort of trying to get round this almost. It's more probably more difficult to get the other version.
Well, maybe they're buying it with Red Hat on, because you can buy them with Red Hat on.
Oh, maybe. You never know. But continuing then, Cuba has got its own GNU/Linux distribution, and that's called Nova OS. Not exactly friendly with America. And that was originally based on Gentoo, but now it's based on Ubuntu, has been for quite a while. And now they've got a new lightweight edition, which is built around the Guano desktop environment, which I hadn't heard of, but apparently is a fork of LXDE.
Who would have a Linux desktop environment named after Pooh? That is the most stupid name I've ever heard.
That Guano's worth a fortune, I tell you.
Yeah, but again, that just, it's yet another example of, you know, this international growth of Linux use that you wouldn't necessarily think about. You know, we always think about the Western nations, and, you know, that's where the focus seems to be. But it seems that Linux and open source is kind of taking root elsewhere, and hopefully we can learn a lesson from them.
I'm not totally convinced that the whole reasoning is sort of security stroke we hate America, blah blah blah. I think the cost value has got a lot to do with it, but as you say, it's picking up all over. These stories keep popping up left, right and center, and they seem to be coming a lot more these days as well. We used to have one or two. Now it seems fairly regular. You know, this country's taken on whatever, has taken on Ubuntu or what have you. Actually, I very rarely see that a country's taken on Debian, to be honest. They take on Debian derivatives.
Yeah, well, usually with some sort of corporate support. I mean, we've often talked about the problem with Debian being, I mean, I know they're trying to do this LTS strategy now, but you don't have that guarantee of support. Whereas if you go for something like Ubuntu, you know you're going to get the 5 years of support for the LTS. And that's much more attractive than the Debian, where you just don't really know how long you're going to get security updates for. And, you know, you're potentially having to update and upgrade a lot earlier.
But we touched on earlier the idea that a lot of these governments are moving over, either producing sort of Linux operating systems at a government level, or indeed moving over to open source. And we've covered that in the fact that the UK government has insisted that open document formats are a requirement, and therefore all documents sent out will be ODF. And the next news story is the fact that the Dutch government are trying to push the same, and they're trying to move over to open document formats, away, of course, from the closed formats of Microsoft. And it does round off our sort of, you know, flying the flag for FOSS type news articles, but it just shows that across Europe, and as we've discussed, across the world, everyone seems to be moving either to make operating systems or indeed to open formats for documents. And I think at a government level, it's absolutely essential, because all Microsoft has to do is say, oh no, we're not going to support XLS anymore, it has to be XLSX, and then before you know it, you know, all your documents won't open and all these sorts of things. So I think it's really important that certainly at government level we keep it in the open formats.
I agree wholeheartedly with that. Next up, as some of you may have seen, is the announcement that Amazon is offering its Fire tablet. US prices are $50, although strangely I understand that the UK price is £50 as well. But more interestingly, they're allowing you to purchase, they're doing a six-pack option, and you can purchase six of these units at $250. And as ever, Pete the salesman is sort of like, ooh, I'd buy six and put a bit of a markup on them and sell them on again.
Well, they seem to be pretty popular, because I know that they were originally going to be available on day of release, and now they've kind of pushed that back to say, you know, it's going to be a little bit afterwards, because a lot of people have been buying them. And I mean, we're talking about £50 or $50 for, yeah, it's quite modest hardware. It's a 7-inch tablet that's only 1024 by 600, but you know, it's got a quad core processor, it's only got a gig of RAM, it's only got 8 gigs of storage, but it has got an SD card slot, a micro SD slot. It's only got N Wi-Fi, so that's not the latest there, but it's got Bluetooth, it's got two cameras, you know, 2 megapixel and a VGA camera, so nothing to write home about. And, you know, it's not got any fancy speakers or anything. You know, it's just got a standard mono speaker. So, you know, this thing is a cheap tablet. But, I mean, at that kind of price, £50, I mean, how can they possibly afford to do that? I mean, they surely can't be making any money on it. They are only going to be making money on the content that you view on it, surely.
Well, I think they've been kind of burnt, haven't they, by the failure of their phone. I mean, everyone said it was a fairly good, or at least good mid-range phone, and it's just gone nowhere. But the tablets, as far as I know, have sold fairly well. I've been to various friends' houses, especially those that have kids, and they just want to, you know, bung them a cheap tablet. They're quite popular around there. However, you are so locked into the Amazon ecosystem, it is just painful. I had a little play with one, and it is awful.
Yeah, I mean, if you are a Prime subscriber and you get a lot of content from Amazon, then it totally makes sense to get one. What I'm interested in is someone going to root them, unlock the bootloader? Is there going to be CyanogenMod available? Because then you got for £50, I mean, that is basically disposable, isn't it? Or if you can find five other people that want one, you can push the price down a little bit by getting this six-pack option. So it's, you know, what it put me in mind of was, how much was that Raspberry Pi screen again? £48 for a 7-inch display with no computer that is actually lower resolution than this. So it's for £2 more, you can get a high resolution tablet. So, you know, and I don't think the Raspberry Pi Foundation are trying to rip anyone off at all. And I don't even think they're necessarily being ripped off. I think that it's just Amazon have got such buying power and selling power, and they're willing to do it as a loss leader to sell the content. But yeah, amazing. I really hope it gets rooted, and then I would consider buying one, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Amazon's whole goal is to get something in someone's hand that puts them through to the Amazon store, isn't it? I mean, if you search for a product on Google, you can go to the shopping section, shopping tab, and it will show you Amazon and eBay and PC World and all these other places. So you have a choice. Whereas if you have one of these tablets and you think, oh, I'll buy something, it's just going to point to the Amazon result. And so before you know, and especially you're right, if you're on Prime, why would you not? You get the next day. It's a no-brainer that they're just trying to funnel your money into something else.
Yeah. One of the failings that myself and you guys and a lot of the people that I know, I think we tend to look at these sort of things from our own perspective of, yeah, well, I would root it and blah, blah, blah. I think you need to look at this as we always used to use the term on our show of Joe User. So there you go. You got, I don't know, got some guy. Christmas is just around the corner. Let's not forget, you know, and I tell you what, there's six Christmas presents there, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there's six. Yeah. Well, if you think about it, you know, I tell you what, yeah, look, love, you know, I can get six of these for 250 quid. There's six presents there. There's one each for the kids, one each for your brother and sister. You know what I mean? And then there's six presents. But then, as you've quite rightly pointed out, Joe, you've got six people then that are not like us, that are quite happy probably to take on the Prime package or whatever other package options are available on that tablet. You know what I mean? I don't think, as you quite rightly say, I don't think Amazon, I think Amazon are being very clever, if you want the honest truth. I think what they're doing, as I say, they are probably using the tablet as a loss leader, but they know full well that the potential recipients of those tablets, and not necessarily the person that's bought it, are more than likely going to take up some of their services that come with that tablet. And that's what it's aimed at. It's not aimed at you and me, Joe. They're not interested in people that want to root it. They want your I don't know, your son, your daughter, who is going to want to view the movies, read the books, and do all the other stuff that's on there.
Yeah, indeed. Well, more Android news then is the BQ Aquarius A4.5, which is part of the Android One project, and that's going to be available in Europe. There was an Android One phone available in Turkey a while ago, but this is the kind of the first time it's been available in Western Europe. And you're talking at about 170 to 180 euros for quite a modestly spec'd phone. I mean, granted, it's got 2 years guaranteed updates from Google and a 5-year hardware warranty, which is quite attractive. But I mean, it's a pretty low res screen, only 1 gig of RAM. You know, a similar kind of spec really to that Amazon tablet. And yet it's an awful lot more expensive. So it just feels like, I don't know, I can't see it really taking off because there are probably better phones that you can get for a similar kind of price. I mean, I'm not sure about those. You get like the Samsung Galaxy minis and stuff. I presume they must be in that kind of price range. So yeah, it just doesn't seem cheap enough, really. I thought the point of Android One was to make it as cheap as possible.
Do you know, I read all of this article and I thought they were talking about the BQ 4.5, which is the Ubuntu phone.
So did I at first, yeah.
Oh, what they've done is they've just taken the phone that they've been using with Ubuntu, which I think already had some sort of Android on it, and they're just shipping that again.
I was thinking exactly the same when I read it, and I thought, hang on a minute, I know I don't know anything about phones, but isn't this the Ubuntu phone?
That was the E4.5, this is the A4.5.
Oh, well, of course, a letter subtle. Makes all the difference. And again, like you said, I was under the impression this Android One was supposed to be the El Cheapo phone, again, aimed at the Indian market.
Yeah, India, China, you know, developing nations generally.
Yeah. So I'm quite surprised at that price level, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, so what would you suggest is a sensible price level for an Android One? Are we talking 30 quid or 90 quid?
90 quid, I would say.
Yeah, I would have said, yeah. Well, it depends, like you say, it depends on the specs. But yeah, I would have said somewhere in the, up to 90 quid. I'd like to say it that way, up to 90 quid, yeah.
Okay, I mean, yeah, you'd have to make sure the specs met the price, in my opinion, is that you'd have to set the price and then say, right, let's make the phone and scrimp on the camera or the screen resolution, whatever it might be, but to have it there. But I mean, like you say, was it 170 euros is way over that price point, and you're not really getting that great a phone either.
I think it's a bit expensive for what it is. And especially the market that supposedly, well, I don't know how much. Anybody know how much it was priced at the? Is it right to say the Asian markets?
I'm not sure. I think it was less than that for similar specs from what I remember looking into the Android One stuff before. So, yeah, I'd suppose it's because they can get away with charging more here, maybe, or they think they can. But I just can't see this taking off somehow.
So, following on from that, talking about Android phones as well, there a new Android lock screen hack has given attackers full access to your locked devices through the lock screen. So much for lock screens.
Yeah, and this is actually quite a straightforward attack, isn't it? I mean, all you have to do is just copy, paste, and just bombard the password with enough characters that it crashes, and then it unlocks the phone.
To be honest, I'd like to know how you can copy and paste it, though. That was my one thought, because apparently this it's not per se the lock screen. It's the camera feature, isn't it? Whereby, you know, where you can use your camera even though the thing's locked. So you try and activate the camera. Well, how can you paste code in?
Well, what it is when you try and get to the rest of the phone, you then have to put a password in. I mean, I have mine set to a pattern, so I've never used a password. So this fairly niche, this, because you have to be using a password as security. But if you are using that, then when you try and get to the rest of the phone, then it offers you this, you know, the input. And so then you can effectively type a little bit and then copy paste that over and over again.
Ah, I see what you're saying. Do apologize. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you had the patience, you could sit there and just bash the screen for a couple of hours. Yeah. But it's just quicker to do it with a copy paste. And that, there's a video of it, and you see it slowing down and taking longer and longer to copy paste as the string gets, you know, it keeps doubling in size. And eventually it does take quite a while. It still takes about 10 minutes.
Right.
And then it just falls over and unlocks it. And it's all devices running from Lollipop upwards, basically, unless they've been patched. And that kind of goes on to the next story, which was about stage fright. And we covered that a few weeks ago. That was a pretty major, well, a very major vulnerability in Android. And the Google PR team at the time had been talking about how this address space layout randomization, which came in Android 4.1, made it so that it didn't affect most phones. But the reality is not that at all. And you basically are still vulnerable to the stage fright vulnerability. And I mean, it really just keeps coming back to this same story of updates for Android. We're used to, on the Linux desktop, getting updates all the time through your package manager. Whereas on phones, you just don't get that. I mean, you get updates to the apps, but not to the operating system itself. And you've just got this terrible situation where there are potentially millions or even a billion vulnerable phones out there in use. And most of them are never going to get a patch, because it's so quick, the turnaround. You know, they produce a new phone, you know, a new version, like Samsung, for example. You know, they have the S5, the S6, and it's only out for a year or so before they bring out another one, and then they just abandon the old ones, which are perfectly useful and still working and being used by all these people all over the world. And it's just a terrible situation.
Yeah, I mean, it almost needs some sort of like governmental layer where it says all phones must be up to date for the next 4 years or something, and therefore Samsung and HTC and LG and all that have an actual responsibility and a requirement to make sure they keep on doing it. But I mean, you're right. Let's say a mobile phone contract tends to last 2 years. So even if they try to keep the mobile operating system up to date for 2.5 years, you know, to cover the people that have bought it in that first year plus two, that's not very long. And with an S5, what have you now, like you say, it's basically going to be good enough for, I would guess, the next 4 years. I've got no real plan to upgrade my phone. And so you need it longer than that. But without having something that is either rooted or stock Android, which comes, you know, like the Nexus program, I don't see how you're going to force either the carriers or the phone manufacturers or whoever it is that has the final say in who pushes the update, how you're going to make them actually do it. It's you know, there's no one responsible for it, is there?
I'm not sure that I agree that the mobile phone manufacturers are responsible for the operating system, though.
Surely they are. I mean, if you're going to sell a piece of hardware, you are responsible for what software is on it, especially if you have taken stock Android and customized it, and that's why it can't get updates. I mean, how can you, if you have altered the code, then Google can't directly update it because they don't know what might break because you've been tinkering with it.
That's a fair comment, but how often does Android push updates anyway?
Well, if you've got a Nexus device, fairly frequently. I mean, I've finally had my Nexus devices patched against stage fright. And so, you know, you do get updates with them, whereas with other manufacturers that have changed Android, you generally don't get them, certainly not as quickly. I mean, Samsung have, in the wake of stage fright, said that they will be doing updates every month, I think it was. But I'm still not convinced by that.
But then if you think about the laptop market, if you buy a Dell, you don't expect Dell to upgrade your Windows, do you?
No, that's where my mind was going.
But the difference there is that Dell will sell you a laptop running Windows, which is essentially untouched, with stuff added on top of it, software on top of it, rather than they don't go into Windows itself and change that to the point where it can't be updated from Microsoft.
Yeah, but isn't all of the Samsung changes that, like, is it TouchWiz they have? I think,
yeah.
And there's all that bloatware and nonsense they put on top, and you're right, they have the Samsung Voice and the Samsung Calendar and these sorts of things, but they're all apps, they're all desktop environments or images on top. Are they really dealing with the core Android?
That's exactly what I was thinking, yeah.
Yeah, even the settings and stuff are all different. You know, they have been altered. Google couldn't update a Samsung device directly without working closely with Samsung because of the changes that they've made to it.
I'm going to say it. It sounds a little bit like Ubuntu have an idea with the click packages and things. If you can keep all the things you want to change in separate containers on top of what is a core base, which is only changed by, you know, in Ubuntu's case, Canonical, but in Android's case, Google, you could then upgrade the absolute core operating system and all the things that the user wants to look at and that Samsung or HTC would want to put on top are simply additions.
I agree. But then I suppose the manufacturers would not want to do that because then you wouldn't be, for want of a better word, locked to that particular device, would you?
Well, on the topic of Ubuntu, the Fairphone, which was released with a version of CyanogenMod, and Fairphone have a sort of very ethical policy behind the manufacturer, the design, and the resourcing of their components, are looking at the potential to switch from Android, due to this vulnerability we've been discussing, to maybe another operating system that would include Ubuntu Touch or Firefox OS or maybe even Sailfish.
Yeah, and that's because they want something where they can guarantee some updates rather than just having an OS that's just abandoned.
And this is, you know, the benefit of the open source is that you can look at it and you can carry on working with it yourself even after the sort of maintainer has gone. And they're very, you know, I think this is one of the few examples where the ethics of the manufacturer is driving their goal as to what they want to be able to do, not speed or apps or sort of usability or the next sort of cool thing. They just want to make sure that they are in control, and they have said they will maintain their phones for I can't remember quite what the time is, but certainly a long time, not a year or two. We're talking, if someone's bought one of their phones and there's no need to recycle it or upgrade it, you can keep it for many years. And they really want to stress the point that you can use it for a long time. And the only way they see of doing that is to go with an open operating system. So they haven't made any sort of claims yet as to which way they're going to go. And they said they're just opening it up as a point for discussion, so their community and the people who are interested can, you know, sort of knock the ball around and have an idea. But it's interesting that Android has enough holes and is awkward enough that they're genuinely thinking about moving over to one of these more open alternatives.
So we talked about a while ago the BBC Microbit, which is a small, even kind of sub Raspberry Pi computer that was going to be given to all school children in the UK, or all school children in a certain age group, I think 11 and 12. And it was originally going to be given to them at the start of term in September, around now, and then it got pushed back to the end of October. And now the story is, and I quote, "We're expecting to start sending them out to teachers before Christmas, and to children early in the new year." And they said, as a result of our rigorous testing process, we've decided to make some minor revisions to the device. Getting it right for children and teachers before we manufacture 1 million units is our priority. So this is not a huge surprise, is it, really? We kind of, you know, we were hopeful that they were going to get it out to these kids and get them coding. And so now it's not going to happen. It's kind of good news for Raspberry Pi, I suppose.
Shades of Raspberry Pi 1, I thought.
Well, in that was they had supply problems.
Well, they were delayed shipping the first batches, weren't they?
I remember getting mine at Odd Camp, so it kind of didn't affect me. But yeah, there were people who really wanted one and couldn't get one, yeah.
Yeah, I think that was through sheer demand, wasn't it? But these guys, the BBC, are trying to make sure they have a full supply. So everyone in year 7, which as you say is ages 11 and 12, gets one all at the same time. And the curriculum is with it. And, you know, there's ways to push teachers to show them how to use it and things.
I can only see it as a good thing when it does, for want of a better word, when it does hit the desktops.
Yeah.
school desktops, that is.
Yeah, well, let's hope that they do actually get it out and the kids do get coding on it.
So I said in the intro that there was sort of some Internet of Things news, and I've classed that last one as Internet of Things. And this next one, I've also classed as Internet of Things. And I generally think that we think of them as, you know, fridges and Nest devices and the sort of drop cams and the small embedded computers that we have in our homes and things. But actually, I think cars also count as Internet of Things devices. They're fairly dumb things that people try and allow to connect to the internet and allow you to, you know, Skype people while on the move and find map updates and all these sorts of things. And the problem is that the car manufacturers are sort of in a position where they want to try and push the latest and greatest and make it look great, and then think afterwards, a long time afterwards, about any kind of security and things like this. And this news article is about a flaw that was found in some of the GM cars, which you can contact the car by phone, basically, and send it an audio packet, which allows access to the car's initial system, and then hackers can get into the main actual computer of the car and basically control nearly anything. And this flaw was exposed sort of 5 years ago, and it's taken them all this time to work out a way of patching it and updating the system so that it doesn't affect the cars anymore. Which, the problem being that they had all these brilliant things to show off in the showroom, but no one really thought about how you would update them. And I think this is what brings me back to Internet of Things devices, is that a lot of them are cool in the first month, but if there's any updates to be done, or if there's any vulnerabilities which are found and they need to be patched, what have you, they just sort of fall down, don't they? People are too quick to make them without any real thought or real knowledge on the security principles which need to go behind them.
Well, I mean, I really do love this phrase of the Internet of Things. What a fantastic phrase that is. But as you say, it is a mad rush to produce all of these devices, and probably with scant regard to any of the security issues. I think it is a rush to the marketplace.
And it's a rush to the bottom as well in terms of cost.
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. But I mean, I think there is one inherent flaw in all of these sorts of things. Pete does air quotes, by the way. All of these devices, be it a General Motors car, are designed to be contacted by something else. And that's where the danger comes in. Because if you've got to have a device that has to be contactable and some commands issued to it, then there's your vulnerability straight away.
Yeah, certainly the potential vulnerability, yeah.
Yeah, if it's not nailed down, they'll have it away. And even if it is nailed down, they'll have it away and the nail as well. moving on from that, Mycroft seeks a full-time developer. Now, I'll be honest, I had to look up Mycroft. And again, this is another Internet of Things device.
Yeah, we've talked about it quite a lot on this show and on the Pi podcast, cha-ching. It's a artificial intelligence system based on the Raspberry Pi and Snappy Core, Ubuntu Snappy. And yeah, they're seeking someone to work for, and they say it's guaranteed of 1 to 2 months work. And then after that, the relationship will be reevaluated. So it kind of depends on how well they do, I suppose, and how well it sells.
How good you code.
Yeah, and you're kind of looking for someone who knows about Python and has worked on similar projects before. So, yeah, it seems like an interesting opportunity, although I don't know who would take a full-time job that's only guaranteed 1 or 2 months.
And being a horrible person that I am, you're only going to attract someone that's out of work, and the question is, why are they out of work?
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. Controversial Pete.
Well, yeah, so someone who's only looking for that or willing to take that short-term contract, it seems a bit, it doesn't seem likely. It seems like a tricky position to fill. If they could, you know, if it was guaranteed for a couple of years, it'd be a different story. But yeah, seems a bit strange, but good luck to them, because it seems like a very interesting project and I want to see it come to fruition and be a proper kind of open source artificial intelligence, because I know that there are certainly aspects of that already available, things like Jasper, but to a whole system that can connect to your house and do all sorts of things is certainly interesting. It's not something that I particularly want myself, but I know there is a big demand for it, and it's good that there is an open source implementation of it available. Moving on then to GNOME 3.18 has been released and it brings big improvements, supposedly. Now, Pete, you use Fedora. Does that mean you use GNOME?
Yeah, I do. But to be honest with you, I haven't updated in a while, so I haven't got it yet.
Are you still 3.16?
Yeah. Over the years, I've been burnt by... When like most people, when I first got into Linux, you know, I was there every single day, update. Oh, yeah, update. And then you learn through getting your fingers burnt a few times that it's always best to wait a little while and let the dust settle before you start doing it. So, yeah, I haven't updated it, so I'm not going to be a very good guinea pig for you, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay, fair enough. So you haven't tried the latest beta, is it 23 Fedora?
No, beta? No. Actual fact, I'll be honest with you, Joe, I only upgraded to Fedora 22 last week.
Oh, right. So you really like to stick on the tried and tested.
Yeah.
Oh, I knew there was a reason we asked you on. You like tried and tested software.
Well, to be honest, you know, it did. My basically, when... And I don't want to get involved in the systemd argument, but when Arch Linux went over to systemd, it just broke some of my system so horribly that, you know, I swore blind that, you know, I wouldn't do something like that again, whereby I would leave myself open. So a lot of my systems are, yeah, they probably could do with updating sooner. So what I tend to do, especially with Fedora, and I know they start working on the next release pretty much straight away, but what I tend to do is, so for example's sake, I only just recently upgraded to 22, and I know sort of 23 is fairly along the road now. When 23 is released, once they start to work on 24, I'll probably upgrade to 23. That's sort of how I work, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
Because especially when I was doing podcasting, and hopefully I will continue to do podcasting, there's nothing worse. I mean, we had it a couple of times doing our show whereby, you know, you do a foolish thing like upgrade or do an update just prior to the show, yeah, and then find that, you know, Audacity didn't work anymore, or Skype wouldn't refuse to work anymore, or, you know, something else broke. And there's nothing worse than that. So, I mean, to be honest with you, I checked out all my systems yesterday, and then checked them out again this evening. So, yeah, I mean, I tend to leave it quite a while before I do an update. And as well, I suspect a lot of people out there, I update from command line. I don't know what everybody else does. Some people I know use GUIs. I always update from command line, and I never ever add the Y flag. You know, I always have a look through and say, you know. But I mean, one of my major complaints, and you might have saw, I did a post a little while ago on G+, was I'm not a happy bunny with the new package management system of DNF. I'm not happy at all. But there you go.
Yeah.
Bring back Yum, I say.
Well, yeah, GNOME 3.18 looks fairly interesting. They've kind of added a fair few features to it. Automatic screen brightness if your hardware supports it, touchpad gestures, They've got some new apps and stuff. So if you're into GNOME, check it out. There's a live CD you can check it out on. I think it is based on Debian. The last one I tried was based on Debian, and it gives you a good idea of what's going on with that. But okay, right. Well, we may have buried the lead on this one. Pete, you've been itching to talk about this, so go on.
Well, yes and no. As I predicted about, probably about 2 years ago, maybe a year ago, that Microsoft would produce its own flavor of Linux. And the news story broke the web a couple of days ago, announcing that Microsoft had developed its own Linux, which it has, but it's not produced a Linux in the style that you and I would know as an operating system. It's basically for, obviously, it's their was it ACS, I think it was called, their ACS systems. But I mean, to be honest with you, even though I was sort of blowing my own trumpet and saying they are, I was right again and what have you. In actual fact, I know some people know this, but Microsoft, in actual fact, has been running Linux systems for donkey's yonks. Quite a lot of their servers, you know, are in actual fact running on Debian. So, you know, they've been sort of involved with Linux for quite some time. They probably, as some people have argued, for their own benefit, they have been submitting patches to the kernel for quite some time as well. But supposedly they've produced their own flavor of Linux. Yeah, I mean, you know, as I say, I was just doing it as a sort of like, you know, oh, I knew they'd do this, and they've done it. Is it a big story? Yes and no. As I say, it's only running on their, I think it's running on their ACS and I think switches and stuff like that. So.
Yeah, it's Azure Cloud Switch.
Yeah,
it's called.
Yeah, that's it.
It's just network hardware that it's running.
Yeah.
So it's not a distro either, because they're not going to distribute it. So it is by the definition not a Linux distro. That's I've seen a lot of people saying, oh, they've got a Linux distro, but it just is not that.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of people went a bit mad with this, and I'm sure that there'll be podcasts leading with this, but for me, I just chucked it in deep down in our news because it's not a big story to me. As you say, they've been using it on their cloud and submitting patches, and so, you know, they have embraced open source for purely pragmatic reasons.
Yes.
In that they can make money from it. So, you know, they've taken the Linux kernel and built some stuff around it to make their network switches work better. And that's just pragmatic. You know, there's no, Microsoft are not going to suddenly open source Windows, are they? I mean, it's just a bit of a non-story to me, I'm afraid. But it's...
I think it's a non-story in terms of how it was presented. I think it is a valuable story in terms of they are showing an interest, which they always have done anyway, but they are actually using open source software. I agree with your statement. They'll never open source their products. You know, they've open sourced some of their older stuff. But I mean, I can't see them ever open sourcing it. But I just did want to pick up on one little comment that you made. And my Pete's personal view is I don't have any issues with anybody making money out of open source software. The GPL allows you. There is no reason why you cannot sell a Linux distribution if you so wish. So.
Oh, no. I've got no problem with people like Red Hat making money from it. That's totally fine.
But I think you have to accept that if Microsoft wants to make money from it, that they can as well. Because, you know, the idea of Linux and open source software is for everybody to use, good, bad, or indifferent.
Yeah, true.
Anyway, Joe, I've never subscribed to this. I hate Microsoft because, you know, Microsoft pays my mortgage. Thank you very much.
Fair enough.
I sell their products. I sell services related to their products. I agree that some of their practices are not the best in the world. Supposedly they now have a new love for the Linux community. I do, like most of my other contemporaries, view that through squinted eyes and sort of say, well, can you be trusted? But at the end of the day, my view is, with regards to open source, everybody's entitled to use it. I mean, I remember going off quickly off a tangent, and I don't want to talk for too long because it's your show and not mine, but I remember when Microsoft was releasing a flavour of Windows 10 for the Raspberry Pi, and everybody was going mad. Ah, this not fair, this is ours, they're taking over. And I was like, but it's open source hardware, anybody can use it. I can't understand why you're complaining.
Yeah, no, and I agree. I mean, at the same, when that news came out and when it was released, I said, you know, it's a good thing, it's choice. You don't have to use it, and you know, that's fair enough.
Yeah, I'm all for choice and freedom, me. That's why I wear a Creative Commons t-shirt.
Yeah. Well, let's end on a bit of good news. It's not even really news. It's just a recommendation for another podcast, and that is System AU, which is pretty much the Australian Linux Outlaws, I would say. They've been going for 16 episodes as we record this, and it's well worth a listen, I would say. It's a bit sweary, so, you know, consider it not safe for work. But, yeah, do check them out, because it's a very entertaining show, I reckon. And it feels to me like the spiritual successor to Linux Outlaws. Some people sometimes say that of ours, but we're very different from what LO were doing. Whereas System AU, it's, you know, two guys in a room together having a laugh, talking about Linux, not pretending to know what they're on about, just, you know, having some fun. So, yeah, do check that out. Right, with that then, that's the end of the news. Let's move on to Over a Pint. When we do shows like this and shows like Pete used to do, I suppose one of the main purposes is advocacy. We're supposed to be advocating for FOSS and Linux. And Pete, you made a post on Google Plus this week, I think a couple of days ago, and it's spiraled and got a lot of comments on it. So I thought, let's have a talk about that. And so, I mean, the questions are, what are we doing wrong? What are we doing right? And are we just preaching to the choir? I mean, you talked about events like OgCamp, where a load of free culture people get together, be it Creative Commons or be it open source Linux people, and just kind of preach to themselves. And you don't really, you're not converting anyone.
No.
And, you know, that's what we should be doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, how do we do that?
In actual fact, we can go back further in the mists of time. Let's everybody swirl back to the days when Joe was perhaps just a twinkle in his father's eye, and people like myself attended Lug Radio Live. And it was the same argument there, to be honest with you. You know, it was just it was a fantastic, great event. All these events are fantastic, great events. Don't misunderstand me. Don't think I'm being disrespectful to them. They're great events. But the only people that attended them were Linux people. Certainly at Lug Radio, you used to have, Seuss would send down a stand. Red Hat would send a stand. I think Ubuntu sent a stand, Kubuntu, you know what I mean? They would all send stands, and this was fantastic. But the people that were coming to the event were Red Hat users, Seuss users, Ubuntu users. And I'm sort of was thinking to myself, well, this is a great jolly for the community. And it's great for us all to get together and all be speaking the same language and having the same interests. But what is the event about then? What, you know, is it about showcasing a new technology within ourselves? That's fine. I accept that. Or is it about promoting Linux? And I've always felt that it was about promoting Linux. And to promote Linux, you've got to get somebody to come along that knows nothing at all about Linux. I always remember when Lug Radio invited a really, really nice guy along from Microsoft to give a talk. And he was sort of like, I suppose, well received. But then, you know, afterwards people were like, well, I don't know why they had him along. And I'm thinking, we should be inviting Microsoft people along. You know what I mean? That's the way I look at it, any rate. We should be going to, I don't know, when we do these events, we should perhaps be getting in touch with the local college, university, schools, and saying, look, we're having this event For example, say, OdCamp, as everybody should know, is on the 30th of October. And we really, I can't do it because I don't live in Liverpool, and I'm not knocking Dan. Dan does a fantastic job. So what I'm about to say, please don't think, oh, here we go, Pete's dissing Dan. I'm not at all. What I'm trying to say is we should be approaching maybe some of the schools in Liverpool and saying, look, we're having this event. It's going to be on Saturday the 30th. It's about free open source software. Why don't you come along and see what it's all about? But we don't do that. What we do is we advertise on Linux mailing lists, on groups on Twitter that mainly are, you know, just fellow Linux users. And I'm like, we need to get it out there. Do you know what I mean?
But don't you think things like the Raspberry Pi are exactly what we need?
Yeah, I agree.
The Raspberry Pi it's introduced Linux to millions of people that potentially have never used it before.
Absolutely, but here's another one of Pete's complaints, and I've said this publicly, so I don't think I'm treading on people's toes again. I was disappointed last year and I'm not picking on OdCamp, but OdCamp last year had a phenomenal opportunity that, in a roundabout sense, I felt was missed. There seemed to be a lot more children at last year's event, and there seemed to be a lot more women at last year's event, and yet they weren't catered for. There wasn't, for example, there wasn't like a pie school. Now, I'm sure that the amount of people that were there, somebody could have run around and said, look, have you got a Raspberry Pi we can borrow? And they could have quickly set something up. Do you see? You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know what's happening on this year's event, but it would have been nice to see something like that—a room set aside, load of Raspberry Pis, get the kids in, out, have a go on that.
Well, you should set it up then.
Yeah, but like you say, it was a surprise to you, as probably a surprise to everyone else.
Yeah.
I thought it was really nice that there was a nice balance of, you know, like you say, families and children and bits and bobs in it.
It gave it
less of a super nerd atmosphere, despite the fact that was clearly, you know, the overtones. I mean, maybe I think slightly differently to your point of view that we're trying to go to these events in order to promote Linux to the wider community. I think they're more for networking, you know, getting to meet people that you maybe only talk to on cyberspace and things. The idea of expanding your knowledge about what is out there. So I went to an open hardware event in London with Joe, and there was a guy talking about whether or not you can bring out the open data from train timetables and things like this, and allow you to promote that through applications and phone apps and things. And the struggle they're having getting that data out of all the different independent companies that run our trains in the UK. Mm-hmm. And it was just something that I'd never really thought about before, or sort of had any way of getting involved with. And it was just it was interesting that you look down the list of talks and shows, and you get to expand your knowledge, you get to learn new things. And I think I wouldn't maybe bring my flatmate, for example. It would just be a wash over him of so much detail. He doesn't know the difference between KDE and GNOME, for example, let alone, you know, systemd and sysvinit and things like this, where it would just be so much alien information. I don't think OdCamp is the place where you'd want to try and introduce new people to Linux.
No, I think that Raspberry Jams are the place to do it, because take, for example, the Egham Raspberry Jam that I've been to a few times and we'll be going to again. Egham's to the west of London. I think the next one's the 11th of October, so not long now. And at that event, you've got exactly what you're describing there, Pete. What you would have liked to have seen at OdCamp. You've got a lot of Raspberry Pis set up doing various things. And I see kids go to these events and they're playing with Raspberry Pis on Linux.
Mm.
And, you know, it's that kind of thing that we need. And I kind of agree with Jesse that maybe OdCamp isn't necessarily the right place to introduce people to these ideas, but maybe we should have events like the Raspberry Pi Jams that are designed to do just that. And, you know, introduce Windows and Mac users to Linux.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, I agree wholeheartedly. I just wanted to sort of rewind a little bit on what you said earlier, Jesse. If, you know, obviously there's a missed opportunity. If they're struggling to get data out of these train companies, then maybe they should have invited them along to the event, and then they would understand why that data was wanted. I won't say required, but wanted. That's kind of the point I'm trying to make. You know, we don't seem to, it seems to me that these events don't reach out to local businesses, for example. Come along to OgCamp. There's going to be a talk on the use of open office, let's say, and we can then talk about the fact that, you know, Italy's taken up X amount of desktops. In fact, I've written it all down here. Italy's taken up 150,000, seats, let's say, of open office, and show, look, this is how you could benefit your, you know what I mean? We don't seem to do any of that. I don't see any of that. I don't see saying, you know, come along to this event, to the local business, maybe the local Chamber of Commerce. Not that I'm a big fan of the local Chamber of Commerce, by the way, but, you know, we don't seem to reach out to businesses or anything or the local media even. It's almost as if we say, well, this is our little event, but we don't want anybody else coming along other than everybody that we know.
Now, I agree with you on the media. I think that would be a great one for, even if it's just a small article somewhere in the Liverpool, you know, Echo or something. Yeah. It'd be fantastic to say, so many hundred people came here and they had this weekend and they had these events. And someone might read that who'd never really got into Linux and might think, oh, well, when it's here next year, I'll have a look. Mm. I do wonder, however, if OgCamp shoots itself in the foot from what you're describing by having the way of selecting its speakers by votes and things. So you can't say to a local business, there will be a talk on this, there will be a talk on that.
You did used to have keynote speakers, didn't you?
Well, and there will be some this year, Dan tells me.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, again, it's not that difficult to rejig the format and say, okay, we're going to have whatever we're going to have. Over the 2 days, we're going to have four set pieces. You know what I mean? There's no problem in doing that.
Yeah, maybe the larger ones, which would appeal to non-users, businesses, local government, whatever it may be. Yeah, I see. Yeah.
And to also to pick up on your point, Joe, you know, again, or was it you said this, Jesse? I can't remember. I think it was you, Jess, actually. So you said, you know, if you brought your flatmate along, he'd be overwhelmed. But he wouldn't be overwhelmed if you took him into the Raspberry Pi section and said, yeah, look, these are these Raspberry Pis I've been talking about. Have a play with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, especially if there are people demonstrating things that you can do with them.
I mean, I always remember what you might remember him. I can't remember his name. I'm awful with names. I've got a terrible short-term memory. Awful it is. But do you remember the guy that came along to one of the Og camps? I think that was it at the Blackie? I think that was, whereby he was using Arduinos to monitor his mice traps in his loft.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that could be interesting. I mean, we're talking really effectively. We're talking about the Internet of Things, but that was sort of like, I don't know, 5 years ago. but I mean, that could be interesting. I just see that there are so many opportunities that we could engage with other people. When, you know, I mean, I see myself as a FOSS advocate as opposed to a Linux advocate, to be honest with you. And so I see so many sort of like opportunities that somebody else can use. I'm sure, I feel confident that if you stood outside John Moores University and grabbed some poor soul walking past and said, come in here, we're going to talk about the Firefox browser, they'll go, and well, I know what that is.
I think the problem that you have at events like that and podcasts like this and magazines like Linux Voice is appealing to everyone. How can you appeal to new users who know almost nothing about it and get them engaged while at the same time appealing to people who are very experienced and, you know, want to talk about things like systemd versus sysv?
By not being so technical and off-putting, because I think the problem Linux originally and still to a certain extent does have it has a sort of a geek label of a sort of a niche geek label, and it sort of, I always remember when I very very first saw one of the first releases of Red Hat. And I remember saying to one of my work colleagues, in actual fact, and saying, yeah, well, that's for geeks, that is. That will never take off. Cause you've got to be, have a lot of knowledge to use that. And the problem is, as you've pointed out, if you start talking about system D and stuff like that, it's going to go straight over somebody's head. So, I think you, to a certain extent, almost, you've got to like dumb things down to gain some interest. And that's why, again, I feel that, using some of the open source applications is probably a softer way of getting people to switch over to Linux rather than saying, there you go. There's this operating system. You've got two ways of updating the damn thing. You can use this software updater here, or you can use command line and like, whoa, I don't have to do this with Microsoft. I leave it on overnight and the thing updates itself.
Yeah, 3 days later.
Yeah, 3 days later it's broke, but yeah, yeah. Or if you happen to hit massive update Tuesday and your machine's unusable for most of the day. But I think you get my drift of what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I mean, that's been brought up in feedback before on this show that the command line is what puts a lot of potential users off. But I would argue, look at something like Linux Mint or Ubuntu, and you don't need to use the command line. I can set up for someone, and they can indeed set up themselves if they've got a reasonable experience with Windows, a Linux Mint machine, and then it's just going to work totally fine and just be all GUI tools. Until they kind of run into a piece of hardware that isn't well supported. But for day-to-day tasks, then they're generally not going to need much help, I don't suppose.
Mm. As I say, I don't see... I don't mind being corrected if I'm wrong, but I do not see people, for want of a better word, venturing into the lion's den. We seem to try and stay within our own walled garden, to be honest with you. We don't want to venture into the lion's den. So, for example's sake, if there is a Microsoft event going on, or a Microsoft orientated event, shall we say, going on, I don't see anybody applying to have a Linux stand there. Now, the argument would be, well, why would we want to do that? They're all Microsoft users. Well, you'd want to do that, my son, because you'd like, hopefully, even if you find one person at that event that goes, do you know what? I'm going to download that Ubuntu. I'm going to have a look and see what it looks like. You've had a success. But if you don't go to those events, you're never going to get that one guy or woman. I shouldn't be sexist, should I? You're not going to get that one individual. That's a better way of wording it. Who, is going to download and have a look at that Ubuntu but it seems that we all seem to want to stop in our own walled garden. I've been posting about the OggCamp event on LinkedIn, to be honest with you. Hoping that other people will see it and go, do you know what? I live in, is it Wallasey or something? I'll go on, I'll nip down there and have a look for a couple of hours. Now that'd be great to me. I see that as a success.
Yeah, and OggCamp having the massive selling point that it's free to go to. You don't have to pay. You can just donate what you feel. And if you're only going to go for a couple of talks or maybe a morning, then you don't feel the need to pay for it. And I do agree with your idea that you should maybe branch out and look at, let's say, Microsoft events or sort of national sort of networking events from the networking as in hardware networking sort of thing. And the idea that you should put yourself out of the comfort zone of Linux is a good idea. However, is it going to be the likes of you and I who turn up and just sort of throw our ideas about and hope that people see what we're talking about? Or would you need a proper company presence like OpenSUSE, like Red Hat or Canonical or someone like this?
Well, with the greatest respect, and I've known Jono Bacon before he was famous. I've sat next to Jono Bacon many a time, and I'm going to pick on Jono and. Because simply he's hopefully a bit of a well-known character. I see it that we need, to a certain extent, more people like Jono to go to events and evangelize open source, and talk to other businesses. I mean, I can't remember, but I know he's been to loads of events, especially across the US before he moved to the US even. you know, and he was talking to businesses and whatever. I know on behalf of Ubuntu at the time, but if that could be expanded to cover all of open source. So what I'm trying to say here, I see that task falls. Unfortunately, we don't really have community managers anymore. Fedora still has a project manager, but someone, you know, maybe, I mean, it was always the argument with community managers of, well, what is it that they actually do? Well, there's something that they could have done. They could have gone along to, what's that big IT thing they have in America? CNET, isn't it?
CES.
So, well, whatever. Yeah, go along to those events and start, I don't know, stand in the middle of the event, handing out, holding up the GPL and preaching to people while wearing sackcloth and ashes. But that's the sort of thing that I mean. You know, I'd never see anybody saying, you know, that they went along to effectively a non-Linux event, you know, and evangelize Linux. No, what they do is they go along to places like FOSDEM and Northeast Linux Fest and, for example, say a bit Blackpool Bar Camp, Manchester Bar Camp, where, you know, they're all Linux users there. You know, these are great events. They're fantastic events, and I love the people there. And like I think yourself said, Jesse, Pete goes to Og Camp. I don't really go for any of the talks, to be honest with you. I go to see people that I get to see face to face once a year, and I spend most of my time talking me arse off. Excuse my French. So, as I say, that's what I think. I think we should just be a bit more inviting. And I think that, you know, some people see being able to talk technically as some sort of, I don't know, some sort of badge. I posted a thing today about, social mistakes intellectual people make, being intellectually showy and arrogant. There you go. I think that's what we tend to do a lot, to be honest with you. You know, well, let's talk about, I don't know, let's talk about Docker and things like that. And people are like, what the hell are they talking about?
Yeah. Well, we could talk about this all night, but time marches on. I'm sure that there'll be listeners out there with thoughts on this. So do get in touch if you've got some ideas about how we can advocate the use of Linux and FOSS. But with that, we're coming to the end of another Linux Luddites. You can email us at show@linuxluddites.com, find us on Twitter, Google+, and the Facebook communities, or leave a comment on our website. Thanks for joining me, Pete and Jesse, and thanks to everyone for listening. We'll see you again next week for more Linux news, reviews, comment, and generally being grumpy.
And it's goodbye from me.
Bye all.
See you later.